And so I thought it's Wednesday night. Let's go ahead and talk about that very important subject of prayer. Now, I don't care who you are in this room. You're on a prayer journey. If you're saved, you're on a prayer journey. You may not know it, but you are. And I believe with all of my heart that prayer is a very important part of the Christian life. I'm certainly growing in it, and I know I've got some room to continue to grow, but I thank the Lord that He is doing something in my heart about prayer. Now, if you do any study of Christian history at all, particularly of revival, you will always note that every move of God is always preceded by prayer, and it is always fueled by prayer. I remember several years ago, it was probably 10, 15 years ago, I heard a man who saw something that very few foreigners saw. He saw a move of God in the country of Burma, Myanmar, up in the hills. They call them the Chin Hills. It was the Hakka Chin tribe. I don't know much about it. They are not Burmese. They are tribal people. And long story is what happened was a couple of men snuck out of Burma to India next door. They were Baptist men, but they were not believers. Many of you know that Adoniram Judson, of course, is a responsibility for much of the gospel there in Burma. But the problem was the Northern Baptist Convention went liberal, and it affected Burma, and largely the Burmese Baptist went liberal as well. So these two young men snuck out of Burma to get some education, went down into India and fell into to an independent Baptist school. I believe Jacob Chelly, I think, was the name. And they got saved, and they got excited about the Lord's work, and they came back into Burma, and guess what happened? The Baptist churches kicked them out. Kicked them out because they started preaching the gospel. And for 2 decades they prayed. 2 decades. It's a long time. And finally God seemed to say, it's time. It's ready. And they got several people to go up fast and pray for a whole week in a mountain. And they came down, and it's almost a story like George Whitefield. They couldn't come in the churches, so they preached outside the churches. And it was not long before they had revival meetings every night for over a year. Can you imagine that? You think you're tired, okay? Every night for a year. And here's what the American that got in, it was a miracle that he even got in, said that literally, as his caravan came into the town, literally people lined the sides of the street, of course, he preached at. And here's what he said the schedule looked like. He said they'd have a revival meeting just like we do. He said the people would wake up at 4 a.m, they'd go down, have an hour prayer meeting before they went to work. Then they go work an 8-hour day, they'd come back to revival meeting, and they did that day after day after day. May I say that that revival, I think 10,000 people came to know Jesus Christ through that move of God there. And so again, only witnessed by 2 white people, only witnessed by two non-Hakka Chin, I should say, that were the only ones that witnessed that. Other than that, it was just Hakka Chin, so it's one of those revivals that was not exploited. It was very indigenous. But not only was it preceded by intense prayer, it was fueled by it. Now you say, why are you telling that story? Because tonight I want to preach on something that perhaps is one of the greatest sins in American churches, and that is the sin of prayerlessness. The sin of prayerlessness. Now, why is it a sin? Let's begin by looking at the words of Samuel. He's speaking to the children of Israel after they had chosen a king. God was not happy with their choice, their desire to have that. He said, go ahead and give them a king. And he showed his divine displeasure, and the people realized they had blown it. And Samuel's saying some things. Notice what he says in verse 23. Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord in ceasing to pray for you. Have you ever read a verse of Scripture and you're thinking, that doesn't sound right? Here's what I expected to say. Moreover, as for me, God forbid that I should sin against you into ceasing to pray for you. Wouldn't you see prayerlessness as perhaps primarily a sin against the people you ought to be praying for? But that's not what he says. God forbid that I should sin against the Lord. Now, why is prayerlessness a sin against God? I don't believe we see it as serious as it is. I really don't. Now, why is prayerlessness a sin against the Lord? Well, there's several reasons. One would be it's disobedience. Doesn't God say pray without ceasing? Now, we won't go into all that. Means I will say this much. I believe that has the idea that dependence is wordless prayer. So I believe pray without ceasing is possible. It means living a life with complete upward look of dependence upon God for everything. But certainly it's disobedience to not pray. And by the way, there has to be concentrated prayer that fuels that that look upward. That's another message entirely. But we kind of talked about that a few nights ago. But certainly it's disobedience to God because God commands it. Okay, we get that. That's simple. But I don't believe that's the greatest reason it's a sin against God. Secondly, we can say, well, it's like you said last night, it's independence. Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and trust in horses because there are many, and chariots because they're strong. Certainly, prayerlessness indicates a lack of dependence on God. And certainly that's a terrible thing. God says, listen, you go down to Egypt for help, you got a problem. And by the way, y'all preacher boys, and I'm sure we got a few in here, don't go down to Egypt for help. You don't need to go down to Egypt to help. You don't need, you know, that, let me ask you this. Are horses and chariots wrong? And the answer is, well, no. But God did tell the kings, don't multiply horses and chariots. Why? Because you're going to have a tendency to trust them. Now, I'm going to get in trouble, but I'm used to doing that, so I'm just going to get in trouble. There's something going on today. A bunch of young guys are flocking to called Idea Day. Anything wrong with ideas? And the answer is, well, not necessarily. But I will tell you this. There's a danger to trust ideas instead of trusting God to lead you to the right ideas. In other words, friends, nothing idea. I call them horses and chariots day. Nothing wrong with horses and chariots, just wrong to trust them. And the danger for young men is to look for the latest program, the latest idea to solve your problem when you ought to be on your knees seeking God, saying, God, what do you want to do to solve this problem? So prayerlessness is certainly a sin against God because it indicates a trust in horses and chariots or going down to Egypt for help, and it indicates we're putting our trust somewhere else. Certainly that's a big deal. I'm not minimizing it, but I don't believe that's the greatest reason it's sin against God. You say, preacher, why do you think it's a sin against God? Why do you think it's the greatest thing that makes it a sin against God? And here it is. Because it limits God. Because it limits God. You say, you're talking about limiting and infinite, like we just heard, Almighty God? How can that be? Okay, here it is. Psalm 78, verse 41, yea, they turned back and tempted God and limited the Holy One of Israel. What? They limited the Holy One of Israel. Read the chapter and you will find out how. Unbelief. Now, you say, okay, run this by me. Okay, we're going to have to kind of lay some theological groundwork and then we'll get this together. Think about these things for just a moment. Remember what Jesus said when he taught his people how to pray, okay, his disciples. He said, here's what you need to say. Thy will be done on earth as it is what? In heaven. Got a question for you, and I'm not trying to trick you. Was God's will perfectly done in heaven today? Yes, it was. Was God's will, and of course, people sinning is not God's will, so let's get that straight. Okay, was God's will perfectly done on earth today? And the answer is, no, it wasn't. So how do we get God's will done on earth? And God says, prayer. Prayer is how you get God's will done on earth. Now, there's two wills vying for what happens on planet earth. Okay, so help me out. See if you can get this. There's God's will, okay, and there's somebody else's will. Anybody know whose that is? It's actually Satan's will. Okay, now, our will, we'll put it one way or the other. Now, I hear that all the time, my will, so I'm kind of setting you up. Okay, now, here's what it is. Your will either aligns itself with God's will or aligns itself with Satan's will. See, that's why we're not really a factor. But those two wills are vying for what happens. Sometimes a young person might say, you know, preacher, I really don't want God's will. I really don't want Satan's will. I'm going to do what I want to do. And you know what I say to them? Sorry, it's not an option. If you're doing what you want to do, you're actually duped by the devil doing what he wants you to do. But you're only going to align yourself. There's two wills vying for what happens on planet Earth. You say, well, preacher, how do we get God's will done? This is the confidence that we have in him. If we ask anything according to his will, did you catch that? He heareth us. And if we know that he heareth us whatsoever we ask, we know that we have the petitions that we desired of him. 1 John chapter number 5, verses 14 and 15. That verse of script verses teach us that if you pray according to the will of God, know you've prayed according to the will of God, thus know God's heard you, you've got it. So prayer comes into union with the will of God, thus defeating Satan's will and allowing God's will to be done. It's a stunning thing. Now let me give you an analogy here to hopefully help you understand why this is such a big deal. Now when God gave the Great Commission, who did he give it to? And the answer is his people. He gave it to people. In other words, saved people, obviously, but he gave it to people, the Great Commission. Now, did God have a backup plan in case we blow it? And the answer is no. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. If I was God, and all of us are glad that none of us are, but if I was God and I was going to give the Great Commission to the human race, the saved people in the human race, I'd have had a plan B. Because I'm pretty sure they're going to fumble the football on this thing. Wouldn't you think? Now, I want you to think about this, friends. This is just an analogy. If you really understand the heart of God, he's not willing that any should perish. That means I believe with all of my heart that God has a plan to reach the world in every generation. You say, well, preacher, why doesn't he get it done? I'm going to tell you why it doesn't get done. Because not everybody cooperates. If they say 90% Christians never win anybody to Jesus Christ, that's true. That means 90% of God's people aren't cooperating. That's stunning, isn't it? Okay, so the point is, God has a plan to reach the world. I'm convinced he does, simply because of his heart revealed in the Word of God. He's got a plan to reach the world, but the problem is, we don't cooperate, and he has no plan B. So it's like this, young man. If God calls you to preach, and let's say your ministry is going to, in eternity, there'll be 10,000 people come to Jesus Christ. In eternity. Okay, in other words, you'll lead people to Christ who will lead other people and start movements. Okay, so if you're called to preach and you resist God and don't do his will, who's going to reach those 10,000 people? And I will tell you, and I think a lot of cases, the answer is nobody. Every time a young man who I believe is God called turns his back on the call of God and walks out to do his own will, you know my great grief is, I don't primarily grieve for the kid, though I do feel bad because he will always have second best and he'll always wonder why he's never fulfilled. He will never be fulfilled outside the will of God. I certainly feel bad for him, but I feel the thing that just, I always think to myself, I'm thinking about the thousands of people who go to hell because that kid did his own thing. Now you may disagree with me theologically, and you can do that, but I believe God has a way to reach the world. And if we don't cooperate. So you say, what does that have to do with prayer? Oh, there's an analogy here. See, some of you say, how can we limit God, that puny little us, because he set it up this way. And when God sets something up this way, he doesn't go back on it. Say, what do you mean? God has set it up, friends, that he gets his will done on earth by God's people praying. And may I say this carefully? There is no plan B. I'm going to put it this way. I believe God has a way for his will to be done on earth today. But he needs every Christian cooperating in prayer. So what happens? Most Christians don't. In other words, what happened over there in the Hakachin? Over a year revival, I mean, this presence of God sweeping through that, people getting saved, a whole people group just reached with the gospel, just a remarkable thing. Okay, was God's will? But my point is, that's probably God's will a lot of other places too. So the point then, friends, is simply this, that God, how does God get his will done on earth? He gets his will done on earth when a Christian comes in union with God's will is done, Satan's will is defeated. Think of it. Whoa! Now, the thing that is probably stunning about this is, if you really understand this, that means, if you get a hold of this, you have just entered the battle. Because Satan absolutely fears your prayers. He didn't fear you, but he fears your prayers. Now, most of us have gone and watched the ball game. Now, the younger men, and some of you older men, remember when you were younger, and maybe you still have this kind of heart. I don't know about you, but particularly when I was growing up, I'd much rather play the game than watch it play. So it's like this. Most Christians are sitting in the stands watching Christianity. They're watching it happen. But when you begin to pray, you leave the stands and you go down on the field. And to use football, let's use football, when you get on the field, you are in a battle. You're going to get hit. You're going to get knocked over. You are going to be in an intense battle, but anybody who's ever played a football game and won, you know what happens at the end of the game? You forget about your bruises, your aches, and your pains, and you think, that was great! And friends, that's what the Christian life's all about. I remember years ago, I was playing in a soccer game, and And soccer's a little bit, you know, football players think it's wimpy, but it has its moments. And we were playing a school that was first year playing soccer. They didn't know how to play soccer. They knew how to play football. You with me on this? So it was just like playing people who wanted to kill you within the rules. Okay, that's how they were going to do it. Just, and I remember I was a wing. I was on the left wing. I was going down the field. Had two big brutes behind me. Dribbled around them, two big brutes behind me, breathing by my neck, and I remember one of them said to the other, "Let's get them." I'm thinking, guys, wrong sport, okay? And let's get them, you know? And so I'm going down the side, and of course, I'm going to cross the ball over. All you soccer players can imagine this. I'm going to cross the ball over and hoping one of my, you know, center guys can pop the ball in the net. And they were really good at that. And our team had been around for a while. We had a coach from Mexico that was just phenomenal. And had taught us how to play and all the ins and outs of it. And so I remember, I knew this, though, that I was going to have to stop momentum enough to plant that foot, cock that left foot, and send that ball over. And I knew that those guys probably wouldn't stop their momentum. So I remember planting that, you know, that right foot, cocking my left foot, hitting that ball, and as soon as I hit that ball, it was those guys just completely took me out. I mean, again, they thought they were playing football. I mean, they just took me down. Hey, guys, I don't have the ball anymore, you know, that kind of thing. And I mean, it wasn't like extreme pain, but you know, the big brutes landed on top of me. I had a few strawberries, you know, a few cuts and abrasions. But when the dust cleared and I looked up, I saw that one of our center forwards had just got that ball just boom, poof, popped it right in the net. Do you know, when I saw that ball go in the net, do you think I went over to the coach and said, "Hey, coach, I got hurt. Coach, take me out of the game. That hurt." No, I jumped in the air. I walked over. Well, you high five. And I forgot all about it until the next day I woke up. I was a little sore. You know what I'm talking about? You know, friends, it's like this. Would you rather be in the stands watching it happen, or would you rather be on the field watching God work? Now, let me just warn you, and none of us need to be afraid of this because Satan is a defeated foe. But when you get on the prayer battle, I am telling you, you get a target on your back. Years ago, I saw a cartoon, and some of you, this dates me. I know all my the baby boomer friends in the room here, you kind of get all this stuff. But how many remember The Far Side by Gary Larson? How many remember? I thought that was one of the funniest cartoons, absurd, totally off the wall and absurd. And one of my favorites is one that was fairly popular. There were two deer out in the woods, and they were talking with one another, and one of them had a big, huge target painted on his chest. And the other guy's looking at him, and the words came from the other deer, and he's looking at him and said, "Bummer of a birthmark, Hal." Well, again, I think you got the humor. You got enough hunters in the room, you got the humor. But the point is, yeah, that's what happens. You get in the prayer battle, you got a target. You say, "Well, preacher, I'm not going to get on." Okay, here's the point. Would you rather be in the stands or out in the field making a difference for God? See, understand that I like what S.D. Gordon says about prayer. Prayer is a battle. Because Satan knows when you get on your knees and you come into union with the will of God, Satan's will is defeated and God's will is remarkably done. And I'm telling you, friends, I'm convinced with all of my heart that the desperate need of the hour is prayer. In fact, that's a really good idea, coming back to it, but that's a Bible idea. Many years ago, I think it was about 1949, I think I mentioned these ladies earlier, but I'm going to go ahead and finish their story. Peggy and Christine Smith were two infirmed ladies on the island of Lewis, and as I mentioned, I believe on Sunday, they were very burdened because it had been 15 years since there had been a major move of God across the island, and they could not imagine that there was a whole generation of teenagers who had never experienced God's reviving presence, and they couldn't take it. Those two ladies, Peggy and Christine, infirm, shut-ins, rarely able to go to church, began to pray. And as they prayed, I think, for weeks, it may have been months, and finally they were praying the battle, and finally one day they called the pastor and said, "Pastor, come, we need to talk to you." The pastor came over, and these two aged saints said, "Pastor, we've been praying, and we wanted to tell you that revival is coming." And here's what they said. "We saw the enemy retreating, and we saw the Lamb take the field." Now, friends, I don't believe they saw that physically, but I do believe with their spiritual eyes they saw it. And they knew that Satan had been defeated and God's will was going to be done, and they were convinced of it as if they had already seen it. Now, some of you know the story, so Long story, they ended up calling in the evangelist, Duncan Campbell. Duncan Campbell came for a three-week mission. We'd call it a three-week revival meeting. And he came for a three-week mission, and he left 3 years later. From 1949 to 1952, the winds of revival swept the island of Lewis and other neighboring communities and islands. It's a remarkable story. I don't have time to go into except to say, why? And the answer is, because two ladies who couldn't do much outside, man, they were doing something inside that cottage, and they were coming to union with the will of God, and they were fighting the enemy. Now, some of you say, well, you know, preacher, I don't know. I've not really heard much of this. Is this a historic view? Well, not that it needs to be, but it obviously helps. But let me read a few quotes here. I apologize. I hate to read from electronic devices. I call this iPad preaching, and sometimes some of the iPad preaching I've heard, the only glow is coming from the phone. Okay, but anyway, let's hope it comes from heaven. But I'm not saying it's wrong to preach from technology. I'm just saying some of the people, the young guys that do, well, anyway, we'll leave that alone. Okay, but anyway, so I usually like paper, but I'm going to read G. Campbell Morgan. Ever heard of him? Here's what he says. Prayer is not, first of all, a means by which we get something for ourselves. It is rather a method, don't miss this, of helping God to get something for himself. Whoa, what a thought. Warren Wiersbe, it has been well said that the purpose of prayer is not to get man's will done in heaven, but to get God's will done on earth. Prayer is not telling God what we want, then selfishly enjoying it. Prayer is asking God to use us to accomplish what he wants, so that his name is glorified, his kingdom is extended and strengthened, and his will is done. Could I put it this way? What I'm preaching tonight is not name it, claim it. What I'm preaching tonight is he names it, we claim it. It's all about his will. And when you and I come into union with his will, listen, you say, well, preacher, I'm not a very mature believer. I'm not very far advanced. Well, aren't you glad that doesn't say this is the confidence that we have in him? If any mature believer asks anything, it doesn't say that. You can be saved 5 seconds, come into union with the will of God, and Satan's will is defeated and God's will be done. I believe prayer is so important. I believe it's essential. God set it up that way. And that's why I believe it's great. It's a great sin, because we literally limit God, bind his hands because he set it up this way. This is what I want you to do. In fact, you read the Lord's Prayer and you'll see, I believe the theme of the Lord's Prayer, the apex is thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And what he's simply saying is, that's what prayer does. It gets my will done on earth. And it can't be done any other way. Now you say, okay, preacher, I think I'm seeing this. Let me give you one more quote here. S.D. Gordon. How many have ever heard of S.D. Gordon? Okay, yeah, if you know anything about this kind of praying, S.D. Gordon taught it. In fact, my grandmother, the most remarkable prayer warrior that I've ever met, was deeply affected by S.D. Gordon. He would come down to Miami, and his sessions there, and the book, of course, the book Quiet Talks on Prayer is what came out of that, were life-altering for my grandmother, so I owe S.D. Gordon a spiritual debt of gratitude. But this is phenomenal what Gordon says. Prayer overcomes him, Satan. It defeats his plans and himself. He cannot successfully stand before it. He trembles when some man of simple faith in God prays. Prayer is insistence upon God's will being done. It needs for its practice a man in sympathetic touch with God. Its basis is Jesus' victory. It overcomes the opposing will of the great traitor leader. Wasn't that good? The way to get Satan defeated, friend, is prayer. Now, let me just give you a couple of examples in the Bible that hopefully will help us understand this. Elijah. Elijah was a man of like passions. And he prayed earnestly that, anybody know what he prayed earnestly about? That it might not rain. Now, why in the world would you pray, Lord, we don't want it to rain? Now, why would you do that? And I'm going to tell you the obvious answer. Because it's raining. Well, you say, preacher, what's the problem with rain? Well, the problem with rain was Deuteronomy. Remember what God said in Deuteronomy? If you apostatize and you serve other idols, the heavens will be as brass. And it's not going to rain. So Elijah said, you know, these people have gone after Baal, and it's raining. So you know what Elijah did? He said, God, it can't rain. Because, God, you said if the people apostatize, it wouldn't rain. And it's raining, God, it can't rain. Now, there's some inference here, but I think it's pretty clear inference. And so you know what God said? You're exactly right. I was waiting for somebody to get that. Hebrews 11, you read it. It says that the people in the hall of faith obtained, anybody know what they obtained? Promises. And I believe, my friend, God's just waiting for an intercessor to stand in the gap and say, God, this can't happen. This can't happen. You know what your book says over here? Can't happen, God. Just can't happen. You know what God says? You're exactly right. I was waiting for somebody to get that. I'm telling you, I don't care if you're 15 years old, your prayer life's important. Doesn't matter who you are in this room, your prayer life's important. Because there's certain things God's going to lead you to pray about, maybe other people won't catch, or you won't be in their sphere of influence. Who knows? Okay, so Elijah prayed earnestly that it might not rain. And he had so much boldness, he basically told, hey, it's not going to rain, man. I've done business with God. I'm standing on Deuteronomy. Again, I'm inferring this, but I think I'm standing on Deuteronomy. No way it's not going to rain. You're in trouble. Now, God evidently revealed to him how long it wasn't going to rain, but the point is, he knew it wasn't going to rain. So, he gets them all on Mount Carmel. We all know about Mount Carmel. The people turn back to God. There's a revival of God. And what did Elijah do? Did Elijah say, in fact, our pastor referred to this in some I think it was a prayer meeting. What did Elijah do? Just sit around and say, well, wow, that's done, man. I can't wait for the rain. Is that what he did? He set himself for praying. You say, well, preacher, why did he pray? Because the Bible says that if the people turn back to God, it's going to rain. Because he understood something that sometimes we don't. God's looking for an intercessor to say, God, you said, this is your will. And I am telling you, Elijah got on his knees. And he said, God, it's got to rain. God, it's got to rain now. Your people are turned back to God. You've got to do it, God. It's your promise. It's your principle. It's not my will, Lord. It's your will. Remember he sent us servant out, and he kept praying. Did he just assume it would happen? No. He kept praying until he saw the cloud, and he said, okay, it's coming. But you see, what I want you to see is Elijah had to come into union with the will of God, and when he did so, Satan's will was defeated, and God's will was done. Stunning thought, isn't it? Okay, here's Daniel, 70 years of captivity. He's reading the book of Jeremiah one day, and God says, after 70 years, you're coming back to the land. What did Daniel do? Oh, that's great. We're going back to the land. Is that what he did? No. Daniel got on his knees, and what did he do? He prayed, and he fasted. And that book tells us there's a spiritual battle I'm not sure I understand. But you know what he was doing? He was praying against the will of Satan, praying for the will of God. Man, God busted through on that thing. And I'm telling you, the people went back to the land. And I am telling every one of us in this room, don't be passive about the will of God. What you need to do is obtain promises. In other words, find out what the will of God is. The Bible has got all kinds of revelations of God's will come into union with the will of God so that God's will is done and Satan's will is defeated. Sometimes we hear a spiritual warfare, we kind of think it's spooky. Spiritual warfare is not spooky. You know what it is? It's getting on your knees and saying, God, Satan's will just can't be done. Satan can't have my son. He can't have my daughter. In Jesus' name, I want your will to be done. And it's battling through. You read it, man. These guys wouldn't give up on the thing. They were persistent, just like Elijah was on that mountain. He didn't stop praying until he saw the answer. God, I've got to have it. Your will. And so the point I'm making, friends, is prayerlessness is a sin against God. Now, why are you preaching this message? I'm going to tell you why. Because I have, in the last 3 years, become extremely optimistic that God is bringing his people back to prayer. Now, I'm only viewing it from one very limited perspective, but I'm going to give you my perspective. Back 3 years ago at my home church, we were burdened about this. We said, man, we just got to have a prayer emphasis. So we were in a staff meeting one day, and we had been praying about this, and I think everybody realized prayer is what we need to have as our theme for the church this year. And several ideas were bantered around, and there was certainly a seeking of the Lord, and then there was the words of Hudson Taylor. We were reminded. Some of you remember when Jonathan Goforth wrote Hudson Taylor and said, I'm going to go into Hunan, which was the most anti-foreign province in China at the time. Hudson Taylor wrote him back and said, we have tried several times to get in. We have not gotten in. He said, but if you do go forward on your knees. So our theme that was forward on our knees. That was the theme for the church. Okay, that was starting in August, and It was January, and our staff was meeting together, and as we were meeting together, the discussion was, how effective has the theme been? And the answer was this: not at all. Staff members were saying, nobody in my Sunday school class or nobody in our department, it's not affecting anybody. Everybody knows we ought to pray more, but it's not affecting anybody. Our staff was really honest. And I appreciate these men. They're honest men. And so in the discussion, you know, sometimes I'm the outsider. You see things. It's one thing with traveling, and Brother Stevens would know this. You come back, you see things people don't see. It's like sometimes I'll walk out and say, somebody needs to fix that rug. Now, why doesn't other people see it? Because they got used to it not being fixed. You with me on this? Okay. They get used to it. And when you come back, you see things that not everybody else sees because that's just the way it is. And so I said to the guys, I said, guys, of course, I love these guys, so we have a good relationship, but I felt I needed to say this, and it was one of those moments that your evangelist gift kicks in. And I said, I think the reason our people aren't in victory in prayer is because the people in this room are not in victory in prayer. Well, that started a conversation. Basically, the men said, that's true. I'm not having victory in my personal prayer life. How can I expect the people I'm leading? So our pastor said, okay, I think we've identified the problem. The problem's in this room. So he said, I want every man in this room to pick an amount of time you're going to pray every day for 2 months. And then I want you to get accountable to another staff member. And so that's what people did. One guy who is one of the most, he's a phenomenal guy in a corporate prayer meeting. He said, you know, I said, I'm really defeated in my personal prayer life, though I see real victory in corporate prayer. Personal prayer is not that way. And he said, I think he said he took 20 minutes. Now he does an hour every day religiously. But in that time, 20 minutes was his starting point. And several of the other ones did the same. Everybody did the same thing. And God began to do something. It was remarkable. It was just a little while after that, our pastor got Dick Eastman's Hour That Changes the World, which teaches you how to pray for an hour, splitting it into five different segments. It's a practical methodology. It's certainly biblical in its things you can implement things differently, but it's at least it's a way to start, how to spend an hour with God. And he got the extended staff together, and he said, I don't want anybody to leave the room. We're all going to spend an hour with God. Some of the staff members said that day, that hour changed my life. Because many times, some of them said, I always knew that I needed to spend extended time with God, but I never thought it was possible. And today, for the very first time, I spent an hour with God in prayer, something I never thought I could do. And one lady said it this way, I knew from the moment I finished that hour that my life was changed forever. Then he introduced it to the deacons. They prayed for an hour, same reaction. Then he took it to the church. And on a Sunday night said, nobody leave, we're going to just pray for an hour. And he led the church in an hour with God. And long story, then he took it to the conference that we have and did the same thing. And the point I'm making is, people make a 21-day commitment. I'm going to spend an hour with God for 21 days. I think of one pastor, I've known this guy for years, great guy, kind of came from a background of just reach inside, try hard, work hard, and I'm all for character, don't get me wrong. But I always noticed in his ministry, he just seemed to hit a wall, he could just never break through it. He came to one of those hours, and God convicted him. He was all energy, all do and no pray. And so he started spending an hour with God. He said, I'm not telling anybody. In fact, our pastor encourages pastors, don't tell anybody. It'll spread. If God changes your life, it'll spread. Don't tell anybody. Get victory in your own life first. Well, this guy started praying an hour, and about 2 weeks later, his wife came and said, okay, what in the world is going on? He smiles real big and tells her. She immediately says, man, I'm going to do this. God, had she seen God change her husband? And he'd been in the ministry for like 3 decades. Then the girls in the family came to Daddy. Okay, what's going on, Daddy? You're different. He told them. And then people at his church started coming to him and said, Pastor, what's going on? You're different. You have to understand, he comes out of a world that most of you aren't probably real familiar with, but a real work hard type, you know, gut it out type of thing. And his church said, you're different. So he says, okay, meet, you know, those who want to, I'll explain what happened and et cetera. And it's interesting, he said his church grew by 50, almost like that. Just whoosh. Now, he didn't do it to grow. But my point is this, is that that's what it's all about, prayer. Now, don't get hung up on the hour, though the Bible does seem to indicate that that's the only time period that's mentioned when it comes to prayer. Can't you watch with me, anybody know? 1 hour. Sweet hour of prayer, of course, the hymn writer. I think we're all familiar with that concept. And it's like this. I remember when our pastor challenged the people that were at the conference. He said, none of you have an hour sitting around wondering what you're going to do with it. So you're going to have to push things out that are less important and make room to spend an hour with God. And you know what happened? People started doing it. And you know what happened? Most of it was recreational technology use. Started getting pushed out of their lives. Some of that isn't helpful anyway in some people's lives. They're not careful in how they handle that. But so people started pulling that out. And in our own church, in fact, I can take you to men right now. They're humble men. They're not glitzy men. They're not what you'd call phenomenally gifted. But I will tell you, if bad news hit me tonight, I'd be on the phone and I'd not tell you, there's some men I'd call that are laymen. You know why? Because they spent an hour with God. Now they carry the presence of God with them. They don't even know it, but they do. I know men who've spent an hour with God now for 3 years. Every day. That's 1,000 days in a row. And it's like this. Oh, man, they must be real legalistic about it. No. Now, once people do it for 21 days, they might start with a little bit of, you know, I got to do this. But after a while, it's, man, I can't. I got to do this. They want to do it. Like one video I saw of a man who started spending extended time with God. He said, I've been saved for 50 years. I've never spent an hour with God. He said, when our pastor came back and said, I want you to spend an hour with God, he said, I did it because he's my pastor, but he said it was sheer torture. First day, he said, I made 40 minutes. He said, I was really proud of myself. So the next day, I got it out 50. He thought, wow, this is great. I'm getting there. He says, I don't know. It's the third, fourth, fifth day, somewhere in there. He said, I'm having my hour with God. And he began to weep. And he said, all of a sudden, I realized God was there. See, the key to spending extended time with God is his presence. That's the key to really spending time with God. It's not a check off the list, legalistic, got to do this. It's, I'm spending time with God. I may have mentioned this. I can't remember if I mentioned this on Sunday for those that were here. If I did, please forgive me. But I sat down at a lunch table and a couple of girls were there. And I was... One of them said, oh, Dr. Jim, we're so glad you sat down. We got to tell you what happened last night. I said, what happened last night? I said, well, our room devotions, we've all burdened. We got brothers and sisters aren't right with God. And we all burdened about it. And we went to praying at 10:30. And they were just had awe in their eyes. I don't know how to explain it. Spiritual wonder was in their eyes. And they said, Dr. Jim, we prayed for 3 hours. We didn't finish that prayer meeting until 1:30. And one of those girls looked at me and she said, Dr. Jim, I was pretty sure if I'd opened my eyes, I would have saw him. Now, she wouldn't have. But the spiritual reality of God was so real. Those girls were impacted. And you know the amazing thing about that prayer meeting? Just last semester, I took a young man on our team who had been right with God 9 months. He was the brother. Oh, backslidden, far for God brother of one of those girls. One of the hardest nuts I've ever seen, God cracked him. I saw that kid preach to about 50 kids at one of the Christian schools we were in. 48 came to get right with God. I walked in the room, there's kids weeping, kids getting right with God. I mean, it was revival, and here's a kid who hadn't been right with God for 9 months. An answer to his sister's prayer in a 3-hour prayer meeting where they met with God. You know what happened? They came into union with the will of God and Satan's will was defeated. Now, it was a battle, you understand. But all I'm simply saying, I feel like, if I could put it this way, that I'm just kind of mining. It's like I've just pulled a few nuggets out of the vein. But it's like this. I think this is where we ought to keep mining. What do you think? And I believe God's bringing independent Baptists back to prayer. I really do. And don't get hung up again. If you say, I don't know if I can do an hour, I would challenge you to try. Not try is the wrong word. Trust may be a better word. Trust and obey. I want to encourage you to spend time with God. Now, again, you can go down the internet. If you put Dick Eastman, Hour That Changes the World, you can download a little PDF, and it's at least a tech, it's something to get you started. What I find with something like that is, like one guy says, I don't even use the book anymore. Okay, that's the point. Every one of us is different. We're going to spend time with God, emphasize different things, but it helps you get started. Spending time with God. And the whole issue of spending time with God is really inculcating His presence so that you can meet with God and through the Word of God, and of course an open Bible I believe is essential in prayer, is extended prayer I should say, is coming the union with the will of God so that Satan's will is defeated and God's will is done. And friends, for everyone in this room, I want to present to you the fact that I guess my burden for each of us is, how do I put this? I don't want you to get in a, like we talked about last night, a flesh dependent, I got to do this, check off the list. No, it's a hunger for God. The key to spending extended times with God is that you fellowship with Him. That the reality of His presence is there. And I realize that we're talking about a spiritual reality. This is not a sensory issue. We connect with God in the spirit, not in the sensory. And it's just meeting with God. And it's so many different things I could say on this, but I'll just suffice it to conclude it with this. I remember several years ago reading the biography of J.O. Frazier. Has anybody ever read the biography of J.O. Frazier? Okay. You need to be acquainted with J.O. Frazier. He died in his 50s. But he was. There was something about his biography that really helped me. In fact, this message would directly come out of his biography as well as Quiet Talks on Prayer by S.T. Gordon. But there's a little book called Mountain Rain written by Eileen Crossman, which is his daughter. And J.O. Frazier was a missionary to the western mountains of China. But J.O. Frazier was, when his youth, the age of some of you college students, he was an engineer. He was brilliant, and he got an engineering degree, and God called him to China. But not to minister to the Chinese, God burdened him for the tribal groups in the western mountains of China that border Burma. In World War II, the Burma Road went right through where J.O. Frazier ministered, but he ministered before World War II. Well, he got there to that people group. The gospel had never been there. It was an untouched field, and he had to learn their language, and he was not married at the time. He later got married, but He began to traipse up and down those hills. Now, if you've ever been to a Chinese restaurant and see those mountains that look like teeth, you know what I'm talking about? They're far more dramatic than in the U.S., just dramatic. That's where he was. Raging rivers down through the valleys, precarious, you know, paths, and little villages built on the side of mountains. They were called the Lisu tribe. They were very demonic, animistic people. They basically worshipped demons. And it was demonology, I mean, it was a very real thing that was constantly in their people. The people lived out of fear. And he would preach the gospel in these villages. Well, for years he'd preach the gospel, he'd see a convert or two here, and it was like three steps forward, four steps back. It was just like he could make no progress. It was like somebody would get saved, and it was like the devil would just destroy him. And he didn't know what to do. And being a logical, you know, guy, he figured there has to be a way to do this. And long story, he had a prayer group. His mother had started a prayer group in England, and they would communicate back and forth about prayer requests, and he began to see God work in a more substantial way. Also, some articles were sent to him that were very helpful about claiming the victory of Christ over the enemy, just simple truth, and he began to implement that, and he began to began to study this idea of prayer coming into union with the will of God. One day he was on vacation. This is after years of ministry. He was on vacation in a fellow missionary's house in China, and on his knees he prayed and said, God, I'm asking you for hundreds of Lisu families to come to Jesus Christ. He really believed the key was whole family units to come because the family pressure was so great. And he asked God for hundreds of Lisu to come to the gospel, and that day he believed he had come into union. And I understand this was not an overnight thing. This was literally months, and he came to believe that's God's will, and he came into union. Somebody asked him later, why didn't you pray for thousands? And he said this, because God did not give me faith to pray for thousands. He gave me faith to pray for hundreds. He came in the union with the will of God. He believed it with all his heart, and he thanked God for those hundreds. Now, he never prayed again for hundreds, but he prayed around the request. This is instructive. He continued to pray for Holy Spirit conviction. He prayed for leadership of the Lord in his preaching. He prayed for power in preaching. He prayed for the enemy to be pushed back. Okay, he prayed around, but he didn't ever pray for that again because he believed he had come into union with the will of God, and that was God's will. Well, 2 years passed, and it was basically the same thing. One day he felt an ethical pressure on him that he needed to write his mission director, and he needed to offer his services somewhere else. Though he knew God had answered his prayer, he felt he had to. But he never finished the letter. In the middle of that letter, reports began to come in. This whole village has turned to Jesus. 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 When all was said and done, before J.O. Frazier died, it wasn't hundreds of families. It was thousands. If you've ever read Isabel Kuhn's books, she came after J.O. Frazier. And God used her to disciple, and she saw the rainy season Bible classes, and she discipled a lot of those converts. And if you ever read any of her books, you will fall in love with the Lisu people. You will. I've never met one, but I love the Lisu tribe. And when J.O. Frazier, of course, he died before the missionaries were expelled, but Isabel Kuhn and her husband John were expelled by the communists when they took over China. And when the communists took over China, do you know what the Lisu tribe was called? The Christian tribe. And I'm going to tell you why. Because a man who believed that prayer makes a difference. And he got on his knees and fought a battle to come into union with the will of God so that Satan's will was pushed back and God's will was done. Now, I'm going to be honest with you. When I read revival history, that's the kind of praying I see. But I'll be honest with you, I don't see a whole lot of that today. I see some of it, and I'll be honest with you. One of the reasons I'm motivated to preach this message to this church is I think God's already begun a prayer movement here in people's hearts. You can sense it in the prayer room when people are praying. You're already on this trail. So this isn't really anything I don't think really new. It's just to challenge us in it. So the sin of prayerlessness, it's twofold, personal and corporate. That's the sin. But I will tell you, for personal, you know what ensures a corporate prayer meeting will be absolutely powerful is God's people are meeting with God alone personally. That's how it works. Now, could I ask every head bowed, please, and every eye closed? Heads are bowed. Eyes are closed. Prayerlessness is a sin primarily against the Lord. Heads are bowed, eyes are closed, no one's looking. Would you just stand to your feet right where you are? Stand to your feet. I believe with all my heart that when sin is identified, that we need to confess it. And I believe the sin of prayerlessness needs to be confessed. God, I see it. I've limited you. And I realize everybody's different, and I realize that some can't spend an hour with God, but I will tell you, friend, if you can possibly spend extended time with God, do it. It will change your life. And I just started to give you testimonies. I could give you literally another 30 minutes of testimonies of people's lives who've been transformed simply by spending extended time with God every day. Spending an hour with God. The heads are bowed and eyes are closed. In just a moment, I'm going to have the instruments play, and if God's touched your heart, I'm just going to invite you, friends, this would be the first thing that we need to do. If God's touched your heart, you say, "Preacher, I see it. The sin of prayerlessness is my sin. It's a sin I need to confess. I'm going to invite you to come and just kneel and confess it. It's sin, Almighty God." And don't say I'm going to do better. No, it ought to be different than that. God, I'm going to trust you to lead me to victory. You know exactly what I need. You know exactly what steps I need to take to get to see victory in my life. It's probably a little different in everybody's life. Practically, it may be implemented differently in some of your lives. But the point is, you say, "Lord, I'm trusting you to lead me. I've got to have victory." Now, heads are bowed and eyes are closed. God's touched your heart as the piano plays. You do what the Lord leads you to do.